Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So what do you remember about loving kindness?
That I forget to do it.
We all do.
Oh.
My God, Bob, you had me. I'm surprised.
That I could do more of it.
Yeah. It's true, though, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, when you actually think about how those habitual motives carry us from one point to another continuously through the day. That way something familiar happens and we just immediately go into the usual mind state that we've done for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years.
Don't go to 80.
No, because I'm just hitting the top of the line here. And that those habitual motives, until we see them, that's the most important thing. Because when you see them, that means you're seeing them without judgment, which is different. For most of us, we see them and then we say, oh, how could I have done that? Or I don't ever want to do that, or right? Mm-hmm. Oh, when am I going to learn? we turn on ourselves,
yeah.
Which isn't the same thing as seeing the habit, is it?
Mm-hmm.
That's just another habit, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You perform an action that you're ashamed of, and then you beat yourself up to make it better, and you crawl around on your belly, being sorry for at least 5 minutes, and then you're pissed off because nobody notices how sorry you are, so then you perform the action again, right?
That's right.
Is that useful? Mm-hmm. It goes round and round and round, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed that at all?
Mm-hmm.
So what matters is for you to see it, just see it, just see the action, and really pay attention and say, oh, this is anger, oh, this is fear, oh, this is self-contempt, oh, this is greed, oh, this is hatred, oh, this is delusion, it doesn't matter. However you name it, you look at it, you name it, and you can do then, you have a series of choices. You can go, what does it feel like? It's my favorite. What does it feel like? Familiar. Yeah. So it's picking my nose. What else does it feel like? I don't like it. What don't I like about it? I don't like where it takes me. Then it can change. Just making the statement you want it to change isn't going to do it. Seeing it, seeing that you don't like it, you make the choice. No problem. No problem. Is that pretty straightforward?
Mm-hmm.
That you have to actually make the choice yourself. You can't keep having outer circumstances that are the reason. Because that's what we mostly do, isn't it? If we can't make time for ourselves because there's so many things we need to do. Right? Or we just want just something to be in the right place. It's wonderful for me having people come and stay with me all the time. It's absolutely wonderful. The cups move. Can't find the salt.
Eggs get moved.
Everything. Everything gets moved. Eggs, eh? Yeah. And isn't that just brilliant? Because, you know, I usually time things. Excellent. Thank you. The other thing that is important to remember is that you don't know when your last moment is. So what do you want to be the motive that leaves this body? This is a good question. And when are you going to practice it so it could be the moment? The moment. This is a secondary good question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want the motive to be when you leave this body? And when are you going to start practicing it? Does that make sense? Because according to my observation, it isn't the action that matters so much as the motive for the action. Have you ever watched people on, you know, when the Santa Clauses are on the street ringing their bells? And some people put money in, and some people ignore it. But have you ever noticed that there's different motives for both of those?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same people that put money in that have the same motive. Some of them are like, and some of them are, and some of them say, sorry, I don't have any money, but I wish you well, and walk by. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
The action can be exactly the same. Can't it?
Mm-hmm.
You can see that in your own being, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
The motive is what carries on, is what creates the sense of self, the sense of identity, the sense of interest, the sense of the direction that you're going to take. Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The motive is called the mental continuum in Buddha Dharma. Mental
mm-hmm.
continuum. That's what mental continuum is, your motive. The habituated motives create the mental continuum. If your habit is to try to be aware of your habitual moments, that would be pretty good, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that you actually aren't afraid or ashamed or
mm-hmm.
hiding or bragging or, you know, renting lights to show them or Bollywood or anything like that. Like you're actually allowing the motives to be there, and you can see them. They're making a habitual motive of wanting to be aware of your own actions, your own motives. What would that do? One of the things it would do, I'm glad to tell you, is because it's way more fun to be kind than to be an asshole, it would make you much kinder. To yourself, first of all, and to everybody else, secondly. Because you can't be kind to others until you're kind to yourself. You can do sacrificing for others. Calling it kindness, but it's really not being kind to yourself. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There's a big difference, isn't there? So to actually be kind to yourself, then you realize how that feels. And then you also realize how nice it is just to spread that out. If somebody really doesn't want you to talk to them, you're really kind, you just, when they walk in the room, you turn your back with a big smile on your face. I gave them what they wanted. It's not the action, it's the motive. Every motive, every moment, the motive can change depending on how causes and conditions arise. Have you noticed that? I have a friend who has a similar kind of thing that she's playing with, that you're sort of dancing around with, and she felt that there was something wrong with her breast. So she refused to look at it. And she used to get her doctor's appointment regularly and she quit having a doctor's appointment. So I phoned her one day and I said to her, I'm going to phone your doctor tomorrow morning and tell her that you've asked me to make an appointment for you. When do you want me to make it? No, don't do that. Don't do that. I'll make it. If you haven't done it by tomorrow night, I'll tell her it's an emergency and you'll have to go within the next 2 days and cancel work. I'm going to do it. makes the appointment. She goes. Doesn't look like she has cancer. Not at all. Doesn't look like that at all. Her fear, however, was causing her to lie, sneak around, be suspicious of everybody. She got more and more nervous. Who knows what her fear could have produced in terms of an illness in her body. Does that make sense? It's the motive that created the I, going from moment to moment to moment. The strongest motive for her was fear. After she saw the doctor, she phoned me, she said, I want you to know I am so relieved. I can't believe it. I can't believe how relieved I am. That was so incredible to go. Because the fear is worse, isn't it? So the fear creates a self who is always hiding, trying not to see, willful blindness, isn't it? So this self who has to, by all means, keep away from the mind any idea about a doctor, has to keep it away. So this self is created moment by moment from the by the fear, always on guard. Change the motive. In this case, have some asshole come in and punch her in the propaganda. And suddenly, the fear's gone, and the motive is different. Then she's absolutely happy one day. But then her doctor said, but just to be sure, because you're so worried, we'll send you for a test. Because it's an old pattern, it's well established, and there's just enough of a possibility there that up it comes again, starts running. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Hi, Bonnie.
Oh,
come on in. So this whole question of just reviewing loving kindness. This whole question of being able to see your motives means that you're no longer being driven by something you saw when you were like 3 years old and you didn't even know what it was. And you understand? Mm-hmm. Most of our deep motives, we don't even know where they came from. And they're not a choice. They're not what we would choose to be. Making vows that I don't want to do that, or okay, I'm going to, is not the same as saying I want to see the motives. I want to 6 times a day check and see what's my motive for right now. What is my motive for this moment? What is my motive? So that makes a different self already, doesn't it? Just making that practice. Mm-hmm. Already there's this self that keeps popping up. So now what's turning the page is this kind of this kind of other motive. It's like the motive is Christmas, meaning I want a present. I want to see what is present. Right? And so then the first page, all right. Got that one right. And then this something else changes as the environment's slightly different. And then the same motive. But now, oh yeah, the house needs to be decorated, right? And then this, everything changes again. There's a slight circumstance shift, but then in the next moment, and you can see that there's a thread linking them all together. The eye is actually on the same page, regardless of what the picture is. One after the other. This spells Christmas, right? C. H R I icicles S T toys M manger A S. This was a Sinclair gift. So you can see that the motive is generally woven through all of these different stories, right? The motive of Christmas, or the motive, I want to see. I want to see what the driving motive is in the moment. I want to see the habitual. They call it adventitious, what is it? Obscurations, that's the word. Isn't that lovely? Mm-hmm. Adventitious obscurations. I like it because it sounds sort of vicious. Adventitious obscurations. That's what, when we're caught by negative patterns, it's called adventitious obscurations. Isn't that lovely?
Mm-hmm.
Viciously true. And to actually be able to see them when they arise and realize, oh yeah, this is an advantage for C to become Cassandra, but instead I think I'm going to give it a candle. Right? Cassandra was a seer, right? Do you remember that? What do you know about Cassandra?
He was cursed with seeing the future, but no one would believe her.
Yeah, she was an excellent seer. And every time she told anybody anything, they didn't believe her. It was terrible. It's one of my favorites, actually, of all those Greek ones. So, see. H. What's the thread that ties one self to the next? Because the self that gets angry is not the same self that gets sad, is it? The emotion is different, you see different, mm-hmm. don't you? Mm-hmm. Colors look different, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Circumstances look different. Worry is not the same thing as faith, is it? It's the emotion that creates mm-hmm. the identity. So the identity can arise in a thread if you decide you want it to do that. But first you have to see the thread you're doing now. That already weakens it. The minute you see it, it no longer has the power. It's not riding you, you're riding it. There's a difference, isn't there? So loving kindness is like the thread of the beads of the rosary that Chenrezig is holding. That thread, one moment of consciousness to the next, when you train yourself to do that. That there might be other motives there too, but the pattern, the overruling motive is for kindness. Because it takes many threads, doesn't it,
mm-hmm.
to make a string.
Mm-hmm.
But when the main texture of the string is loving kindness, then that's what Chenrezig's right hand is holding. You all remember that, right? Wrong? Unsure? So then the next one was compassion, wasn't it? What do you remember about compassion?
The water lily growing from the muck. Blooming into not muck.
The sun and the
yeah.
You know, you've seen water lilies growing, haven't you, on ponds
mm-hmm.
and marshes. And they usually they come about that high above the water before they open in the wild. Don't they?
Mm-hmm.
They like to be about that anyway, that high. So they go from the mud through the muddy water into the clear air and open. And the same that is true of compassion. When you actually realize through your practice of loving kindness how it's not a lot of fun to suffer from mind states. And you actually, then you see someone else caught in suffering. You think, wow, you know what it's like to be in the mud, and you know that you prefer to be in the open, in the wide open, creating nectar that bees come dancing around for. Okay. creating honey in the universe. You know that you prefer that. So you immediately, you don't have to turn away because it doesn't make you feel overburdened or anything. You immediately just wish them to be happy. And you wish, you know, may they see the way to grow out of their suffering. And that immediately makes it easier for you as you're walking by them, even not even having to say a word, to just inspire them to start looking for a way out of their suffering. You don't have to do a thing. Just that inspiration. You know that from when you've actually helped somebody by just sitting with them and understanding what they're saying and seeing their beauty at the same time. Don't you? You know that they can feel that there's a way to grow out of the mud. Just from, you don't have to open your mouth, do you? That's compassion, isn't it? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a time when the person was talking to me and I kept, initially I started to offer little things, and then they finally screamed, "Jesus Christ, I just want somebody to listen to me." That gave you a beautiful piece of insight for every other circumstance you gave.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
Yeah, because then your motive isn't to make it.
That's right.
There, dear. Yeah, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
It's like to be open. And share, you can share, you know, there's nothing wrong with sharing suffering. It's actually a very great communion. Isn't it? Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It opens your eyes to the humanness, to the livingness of the moment, in a way that nothing else does. So that's loving kindness and compassion. Any questions, answers, comments, complaints? I'm wearing several identities tonight. I got the blue jeans from my days at the farm, my native slippers.
Mm-hmm.
My cowgirl shirt, and my Seychelles t-shirt. A little bit of hippiedom in it. You're getting it all.
And the thread through it all.
And the thread through it all. What is going on here? This is, by the way, a really beautiful book. This is a commentary on the Heart Sutra. I really, I'm reading it for the fifth time. I find it very, very beautiful. By Chan Master Shen-Yen. I think he has centers, or he had centers all over the place. And this was printed a while ago, probably. eleven years ago. Really very worth reading. One of the things about packing is that you get to find things that that you can't remember you had until you open them. For example, a little booklet on meditations that I think it was George Dawson at that point, teacher that I studied with. We're giving a similar meditation for the Western Mysteries to the blue flower that you, some of you are very familiar with through your interaction with me and with the Sakya school, where you had to draw a blue circle, and it shouldn't have too much interest in it. And then you try just exactly the same. It was a circle instead of the blue flower. And in the process of that, I came across, this looks like my friend Catherine Boudreau's writing, something that she read to me that I said, I want to write that down. There's nothing wrong with the world. What is wrong is in the way you look at it. This is about sympathetic joy. It is your own imagination that misleads you. Without imagination, there is no world. Your conviction that you are conscious of a world is the world. Remember those tapes on the senses? The world you perceive is made of consciousness. What you call matter is consciousness itself. You are the space in which it moves, the time in which it lasts, the love that gives it life. Cut off imagination and attachment, and what remains? See it as it is, not through the screen of desire and fear. Everything moves according to its nature. Where is the need of a policeman? Every action creates a reaction, which balances and neutralizes the action. Everything happens, but there is a continuous canceling out. And in the end, it's as if nothing happened. The reality is indefinable and indescribable. The objective universe has structure, is orderly and beautiful. But structure, patterns, plan imply constant constraint and compulsion. The world is absolutely free. Everything in it is self-determined. Order comes spontaneously and immediately because of its timelessness. The point of now, it gives momentary being a fleeting sense of reality. In full awareness, contact is established. It needs effortless, unself-conscious attention. There is nothing wrong with our world. It is our thinking ourselves separate from it that creates disorder. No distinction between body and universe. Each is the cause of the other. Each is the other in truth. The notion, I see, I feel, I think, I do, must disappear from the field of consciousness. What remains when the false is no more is real. Without love and will, inspired by love, nothing can be done. Merely talking about reality without doing anything about it is self-defeating. There must be love in the relation between the person who says I am and the observer of that I am. The observer considers himself apart from the observed. It is only when the observer accepts the person as a projection or manifestation of himself, and so, to say, takes the self into the capital S self, the duality of I and this goes in the identity of the outer and the inner, the Supreme Reality manifests itself. This union of the seer and the seen happens when the seer becomes conscious of himself as the seer. It is not merely, he is not merely interested in the seen, which he is anyhow, but he is also interested in being interested. Giving attention to attention. Aware of being aware. Affectionate awareness is the crucial factor that brings reality into focus. Awareness comes from the Supreme and pervades the inner self. The so-called outer self is only that part of one's being of which one is not aware. The body defines the outer self, consciousness the inner. You see me smoking. Find out for yourself, how did you come to see me smoking? And you will easily realize that is your I am the body state of mind that is responsible for this seeing. Go beyond your concepts and ideas. In the silence of desire and thought, the truth is found. Earnestness is the golden key. So right now you're breathing, right? Just watch your breath. Just feel your breathing. When you breathe in, feel it in your lungs. While you're breathing, be aware of the posture of your body. Where you feel the pressure in your body, where you feel coolness or warmth. While you're breathing and feeling your body here in space, feel the space, feel the floor, the ceiling, the walls. Notice that becomes a kind of a clarity in your mind when you do that. You notice that? You're not closing your eyes, I hope. Do you notice that or not? I can't hear
yes.
you.
Yes.
You notice that clarity? You notice how you think you can't speak or identify sound because the clarity will disappear? Notice how you want to cling to it? It's a fucking bullshit. Forget it. The clarity's always there.
That's awesome.
It's the I who's afraid that gets in the way.
The I that's
afraid. Or possessing or whatever. That clarity's always there. You're still breathing. You're still in the room. Your only state of being is still present. Even the thoughts are dancing in the state of being. In the clarity. Nothing is separate from the clarity. We'll be back at that in a moment. This is from A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson. You know that book? For you to be here now, trillions of drifting atoms had somehow to assemble in an intricate and intriguingly obliging manner to create you. It's an arrangement so specialized and particular that it has never been tried before. It will only exist this once. For the next many years, we hope, these tiny particles will uncomplainingly engage in all the billions of deft cooperative efforts necessary to keep you intact and let you experience the agreeable but generally underappreciated state known as existence. Isn't that just lovely?
Yeah.
Why atoms take this trouble is a bit of a puzzle. Being you is not a gratifying experience at the atomic level. For all their devoted attention, your atoms don't actually care about you. Indeed, they don't even know that you're here. They didn't even know that they are here. They're mindless particles, after all, and not even themselves alive. It's a slightly arresting notion that if you were to pick yourself apart with tweezers one atom at a time, you would produce a mound of fine atomic dust, none of which had ever been alive, but all of which had once been you. Yet somehow, for the period of our existence, they will answer to a single overarching impulse to keep you, you. The bad news is that atoms are fickle, and their time of devotion is fleeting, fleeting indeed. Even a long human life adds up to only about 650,000 hours. It's interesting in hours, isn't it?
Oh, true.
And when that modest milestone flashes past, or at some other point thereabouts, for reasons unknown, your atoms will shut you down, silently disassemble, and go off to be other things. And that's it for you. Still, you may rejoice that it happens at all. Generally speaking, in the universe, it doesn't. So far as we can tell. This is decidedly odd, because the atoms that so liberally and congenially flock together to form living things on Earth are exactly the same atoms that decline to do it elsewhere. Whatever else it may be, at the level of chemistry, life is curiously mundane. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, a little calcium, dash of sulfur, a light dusting of other very ordinary elements. Nothing you wouldn't find in any ordinary drugstore. And that's all you need. The only thing special about the atoms that make you is that they make you. That is, of course, the miracle of life. Whether or not atoms make life in other corners of the universe, they make plenty else. Indeed, they make everything else. Without them, there would be no water, or air, or rocks, no stars, planets, no distant gassy clouds, or swirling nebulae, or any of the other things that make the universe so usefully material. Atoms are so numerous and necessary that we easily overlook that they needn't exist at all. There is no law that requires the universe to fill itself with small particles of matter, or to produce light and gravity and the other physical properties on which our existence hinges. There needn't actually be a universe for them to float about in. For the longest time, there wasn't. There were no atoms and no universe for them to float about in. There was nothing, nothing at all anywhere. So thank goodness for atoms. But the fact that you have atoms and that they assemble in such a willing manner is only part of what got you here. To be here now, alive in the 21st century and smart enough to know it, you also had to be the beneficiary of an extraordinary string of biological good fortune. Survival on Earth is a surprisingly tricky business. Of the billions and billions of species of living things that have existed since the dawn of time, most, 99.99%, are no longer around. Life on Earth, you see, is not only brief, but dismayingly tenuous. Mm-hmm. It is a curious feature of our existence that we come from a planet that is very good at promoting life, but even better at extinguishing it. The average species on Earth lasts for only about 4 million years. So if you wish to be around for billions of years, you must be as fickle as the atoms that made you. You must be prepared to change everything about yourself, shape, size, color, species, affiliation, everything, and to do it repeatedly. That's much easier said than done, because the process of change is random. To get from protoplasmal, primordial, atomic globule to sentient, upright, modern human has required you to mutate new traits over and over in a precisely timely manner for an exceedingly long time. So at various periods over the last 3.8 billion years, you have abhorred oxygen and then doted on it, grown fins and limbs and jaunty sails, laid eggs, flicked the air with a forked tongue, been sleek and furry, lived underground, lived in trees, been as big as a deer and as small as a mouse, and a million things more. The tiniest deviation from any of these evolutionary shifts in your might now be licking algae from a cave, from cave walls, or lolling walrus-like on some stormy shore, or disgorging air through a blowhole in the top of your head before diving 60 feet for a mouthful of delicious sandworms.
Oh my.
Not only have you been lucky enough to be attached since time immemorial to a favored evolutionary line, but you have been extremely, let's say miraculously, fortunate in your personal ancestry. Consider the fact that for 3.8 billion years, a period of time older than the Earth's mountains and rivers and oceans, 3.8 billion years, every one of your forebears on both sides has been attractive enough to find a mate. Healthy enough to reproduce. And sufficiently blessed by fate and circumstances to live long enough to do so. Not one of your pertinent ancestors was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stranded, stuck fast, untimely, wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly, in you.
You must have a lot of fun unpacking this
business. Well, this one is, yeah, this the book is, yeah, this is just Bill Bryson. So when you see these two things together, these two ideas together, you get this sense of the futility of thinking, if you're going to be practicing sympathetic joy, loving kindness and compassion, use thought, use subject object. Sympathetic joy and equanimity, they're in the heart. They come from a state of being. This is knowing, this is being. When you come to this, you have to again just be where you are, you're breathing. Don't change anything, just feel your breath. You're breathing here in this room, feel your body. Just be aware of where you feel it. No complaints, nothing to change. No special postures, nothing to do. Breathing, feel your belly move. The wall behind you, the floor beneath you, the other three walls, the ceiling. Feel yourself here in space, just breathing. And there's that clarity again. That clarity has always been here, we just haven't been looking at it. We've been going to the brain, not to being. Every being is already a shining angel. Just like you can feel in the room right now, the quality of, what would you call it? being magic. No time, no past, no future. The immensity of the present moment. Clarity of that. Sympathetic joy is when you sit in that place without forgetting it, without having to block out the relative world of loving kindness and compassion. You don't have to block it off. Because you see that is there all the time, that clarity, that beauty, that profound dancing energy of being. Whether the atoms are going off your body or coming into your body. There's no end of being. There may very well be an end of knowing a self. Being, there is no end. It transcends. Sympathetic joy is when you walk around and you see everybody like that. And especially when they have good fortune, you can just see them like opening to the present moment. So when they have joy, your joy gets even better because you see they're close. Even when someone is in sorrow, you can feel them being in the present. But you can have a sense of compassion that they don't see themselves in the present. Atoms dancing in and out all the time. Where do you? It's this guy I knew many years ago, before I met the bhikkhu. This schizophrenic guy was quite a good friend of mine. We were sitting together once. That's when I used to be called Sam. Sitting beside each other, he's telling me about being released from the hospital, but having to go in for day checks every day. And he puts his finger on my arm and he says, "Where do you end and I begin?" Even if we're not touching, where do you end and I begin? Touching. Everything is interconnected. Why hold so hard to a separateness? There's nothing to be separate from. So as far as I'm concerned, that's sympathetic joy. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? It's just to sit in the state of being, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that thoughts can't happen, it's just that you just have to be being. Be present. There isn't any time in that space, is there? Is there? So these two hands that he's got, they're in the relative world, and these two hands are the transcendent. sympathetic joy and equanimity. Loving kindness, compassion, that's how we work in the relative world. Sympathetic joy and equanimity, that's the heart that makes it all so powerful. It's beautiful symbolism, isn't it? And according to them, that's when we're happiest, when we're doing that. They say that.
Wait, they?
Yeah. Well, indeed. Just a minute, I'll check. So is that adequately sufficient there? Jack isn't sure. So you notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts. It's just it spreads through your skin. Goes right with your breath, with all the atoms popping off your body all the time. All the atoms coming into your body all the time. Goes both ways. Fills this room. Moves out in the world as far as it needs. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, it's just temporarily assuaged. You think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so that there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering.